welcome to this edition of Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host for this episode, Dr. Sarah Weiss from Atlanta, Georgia. And today I'm joined by Drs. Do-Yon Cho and Brad Woodworth from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Drs. Cho and Woodworth are authors on the recent IFAR publication, Prevalence of Cystic Fibrosis Carrier Status in Chronic Rhinosinusitis Without Nasal Polyps. We'll be discussing this paper today. So welcome, Do and Brad, and congratulations to you and your co-authors on the paper.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being here today. Yes.
And thank you for inviting us.
So let's get right into our discussion. Practitioners who treat chronic rhinosinusitis are likely aware that there's a very high prevalence of sinus disease in the cystic fibrosis population. In many patients with cystic fibrosis, chronic rhinosinusitis can be quite severe and often has substantial impact on patient quality of life. In fact, I often tell the residents and fellows that I teach over the span of my career that taking care of sinus disease in patients with cystic fibrosis has really been one of the most impactful areas of my practice. We've also seen incredible advances in research and care related to CF in recent decades, and you all have been on the forefront of a lot of this new knowledge. So I was hoping that we could start our discussion off with a few comments from each of you, Do and Brad, on the current state of sinus care in cystic fibrosis patients before we get into the article specifically. I don't really want to miss the opportunity to hear from some of our world experts in this arena while we have you here on this podcast. So why don't we start with Brad?
Thanks, Sarah. So when I was a fellow back in 2007, I found the CF population being the most difficult treatment population there was. And so we would do these surgeries that we think were going to help and cure these people, but what ends up happening is they just reaccumulate pus and mucus, and it was a very challenging, frustrating patient population. And so I always have loved taking challenges, and so that's kind of where I focus my area of research. And so when I got recruited down to the University of Alabama at Birmingham, they have an excellent cystic fibrosis center, and I joined forces with some of the investigators here and developed my lab in that time. And it was focused on cystic fibrosis and trying to come up with new treatment paradigms that might help them. At the same time, I kept hearing about these CFTR modulators, which had been identified through high throughput screening, particularly the CFTR modulator ivacaftor, which we were working a fair amount with in the lab at the time in vitro. But they started doing the clinical trials, and then in 2012, it got approved by the FDA for G551D patients. And so this whole forefront of identifying these small molecules that can interact with CFTR and improve the ability for these patients to transport chloride and bicarbonate in their airway, this was kind of like the cutting edge at the time. And then when 2012 came, ivacaftor came, I saw the results in these patients who were G551D patients, and their CF sinus disease would improve dramatically. And at the time, my thought process was, well, this is also could affect people with regular chronic sinusitis, because we know that the CFTR modulator ivacaftor actually improves CFTR-related chloride and bicarbonate transport in normal airways too. It augments what's normally there. So, and I also had this theory, and the basis of my NIHR01 was acquired CFTR dysfunction and using ivacaftor to improve that aspect of things. Since that time, they've developed triple combination therapy. Basically, this is a combination of two CFTR modulators that interact with the F508del protein, which normally is called a class 2 mutation. It gets misprocessed and degraded by the cytoplasm, by the cell. And so it never makes it to the cell surface. Less than 1% of protein gets to the cell surface. So they identified two modulators, which originally was Orecombi, which had a combination of, what was the
Lumacaftor.
Yeah, thank you. Lumacaftor. Thank you. And so, and then they've discovered that tazacaftor was a bit better with less side effects. But then they came out with elexacaftor, which the combination of those two modulators essentially increased the amount of protein that came to the cell surface. And then they used ivacaftor which was for gating mutations, particularly G551D, where there's a normal amount of protein on the cell surface, and that allows the gating of the channel to improve. The combination of those three drugs has revolutionized the treatment of CF. And so I know that you've seen it in your practice. It's quite amazing. I see these patients who were the most challenging of all our patients, and they come in and they don't have sinus disease anymore. I mean, they may have obstructive scarring or something that might need surgery, but in general, they're much, much better. They've improved remarkably. I had a really unique experience one time because I think it was back in 2021, maybe, or 2022. I needed to get some cell scrapings. And so I went to the CF floor, you know, took a look around for some of my patients that would kind of be frequent flyers. And I noticed that the S6, which is kind of the CF floor, was completely, was really kind of a, there was a couple patients, whatever, but I was looking at the charts and I'm like, wait a minute, there wasn't this single CF patient on the floor at that moment, which normally you'd have like anywhere from 10 to 20 patients admitted with an exacerbation. Not to say they don't get admitted for exacerbations, but it was this unique moment in time where I was like, wait a minute, we don't have any CF patients. I talked to the nurse, like, where are all the CF patients? Like, she's like, yeah, isn't it great? I was like, this is amazing. And so it's just really been an absolute boon, blockbuster drug for the treatment of these patients with this disorder.
I have to say, I agree. The changes over the span of my career in this particular disease process has been, it's just been really palpable.
Yeah.
How the, you know, the sinus disease that we used to see so frequently and the lung disease and the severity of it has really changed over time. These patients are living healthier lives in general, and it's so great to see. And, you know, I do recognize that that's not everyone with CF qualifies for the drugs that are currently available, but they've been so impactful for the patients that do qualify for them and do well with them. Why don't we kind of jump into the paper itself? So what led you all to do the current study, the paper that we're focusing on today, relating to the prevalence of CF carrier status in chronic rhinosinusitis without polyps? I'd love to hear if you all could discuss a bit about your overall aims in performing this work. What were the objectives and what were you hoping to learn from it?
Let Doe kind of take the wheels on the generations of study. But I will say that, as I mentioned before, the subject of my NAHR1 was acquired CFTR dysfunction, and we're looking at ivacaftor. And as part of that was CFTR screening and genetic screening. And so what I'd find is, you know, these tests aren't that expensive. It's just a generic screen for greater than 40 mutations. It's greater than 90% of mutations that we have. So there are 10,000 mutations of CFTR gene, but this test isn't expensive. So what I started doing, because we'd hit quite a bit on these patients who had, I would like sign them up for the study and they like have Pseudomonas. I'm like, okay, great. I've just got to make sure you don't have CF. And then they have a positive CFTR gene. And I'm like, dang it. So I actually just started kind of screening everyone with recalcitrant disease, because as part of my standard panel, I'd get like a, you know, CBC with DIF to check eosinophilia, you know, immune labs, that kind of thing. But I started incorporating the CF gene panel, and it comes to show, it's like it just a really high frequency of hits we were seeing with people with recalcitrant disease. Now I'll let Doe take it from here about the generation, the study concept.
Yes. So the first thing is exactly what the Brett says. He's our one study that we do a lot of screening patients. And then one patient is really surprised about it. Like, you know, I saw one patient and I presented like 2023 at the Physician Grand Round and National CF meeting. And then we talk about one patient that she's like 60 years old. And then she's referred by one of our local like graduates, the ENT, and then she's keep on coming frontal sinus disease. And then I'm looking at her, and then like she's coughing staph and Pseudomonas infections, and frontal sinus, even though her frontal sinus is open, but whenever she's infection every 3 or 4 months. So and then I don't understand why. I mean, there are people talking about endotype phenotypes, but like people about IL-4, 13s and interferon gamma, like blah, blah, blah. But I feel like there's something other, like there's more than this. Like, so I just explore some options, and then her face is always really pale. So I ask her why your face is so pale. Oh, because she said, I had a Whipple's procedure in the 80s because I have pancreatitis. I said, like, are you kidding me? So any lung disease. And she said, well, I have asthma or something. And then I just, the CF, and she's turned out to be CF positive. So she's a cystic fibrosis disease. So I presented a case with Gary Cutting from Johns Hopkins at the national CF meetings. And he said that CF disease is a, that's 2023 before I studied, but CF disease is now considered a spectrum disease, not like something that black and white. So which means that depending on how much chloral function, some people have better phenotypes and some people doesn't have a good phenotype. So which means that based on chloride functions that you could have earlier signs of disease, but if your chloral function is relatively good, which means you could have a later disease. So that's why, oh, that's very interesting. So that's the main reason that we're trying to explore some options about like why there are certain patients like have very bad Pseudomonas or staph infections. And see, that's what the background of study. And then I noticed that the, because the, Gary Cuttings with the Jean Kim published a very landmark paper early 2000 in JAMA, their prevalence about the CF disease. But there it looks like when I go over their paper, it looks like they went CRS with, without all the all the patients. They said it's about 8% or something. But I thought when I'm looking at our population, it looks like it's higher. Because we always try to find out, like, you know, there's some obvious phenotype. For example, we can do endotype in the clinic, but the patient who's a nasal polyp, allergy, eosinophil high, I mean, those patients even may not be, you know, really the CF disease. So I talked to Brent Senior also. She said, yeah, just only focus on the non-polyp will be very focused on. So that was the main reason that we focus on the without polyp first, mostly about like those phenotypes and see how that goes. But I was surprised that like about 16% of patients without, you know, eosinophilic CRS with purulence, they really have about 16% of those patients are CF carriers, CF TR mutations. That was kind of like eye-opening that, wow. The question is like, now the question is why these patients developing these bad infections. So that's what we're currently working on right now. Fortunately, we do have CF carrier rabbits now. So we're actually exploring why these rabbits also may have worsening disease. That's how we're currently working on it. So that was one of the things. So these, the background of the study that like founding based on our clinical observations that something cannot be explained just by why certain patients, if they're good sinus surgeries and give antibiotic, they keep on coming back. So how can we manage those patients? So part of these patients, everybody was carrier, we always send it to the CF clinic here. And then now what they're seeing is that now the CF, because of the Trikafta, they're kind of like, there was pretty like, you know, their clinic wasn't busy, but now because there are a lot of referrals from our clinic.
Yeah, our clinic.
Yeah.
And they're CFTR related, yeah.
Yeah, but they also said that another population coming from GI issues, like certain mutations coming as constipations, and the GI clinic also did a lot of screening. They also have CF carriers. So they don't like airway phenotypes, but more of a GI phenotype. There's certain genetics. So now they said their CF clinics are, they're pretty much a lot of patients coming from our referrals and our GI referrals. So, and then based on that, I think that sweat chloride testing, that insurance really coverage is kind of a little tricky. But their CF sweat chloride testing was kind of like very positive or inconclusive, which means higher than normal. I think that those patients can also be candidate for Trikafta. That will be the new, that will be the drug that actually can be covered by insurance. So few of our patients are on that medication. And fortunately, there's a new drug just came out approved by FDA in January. That's like current Trikafta is twice a day dose, Manal. They're currently doing once a day dose, which means they probably can be more convenient for those patients. So they're actually upgrading the next level for drugs. But interestingly enough that some of these patients are able to get a beneficial from those medications now. So that was kind of like, then I give a similar grand rounds in other institutions. They also started sending these patients CF clinic. Also, some of these patients carriers also getting the this medication is not only from our institutions, other institutions looks like it. Yeah.
So the little more background on, you know, even though CF is a technically autosomal recessive, right? Yeah, when you have one copy of the gene, these people, you know, kind of depends on you can have different levels, and that's what Doe was talking about, and of CFTR function that actually is generated by the cell. So you end up with this CFTR related disorder, right? It's not CF, but it's CFTR related disorder. Like idiopathic pancreatitis sometimes is diagnosed as a CFTR related disorder. And that's generally what we're seeing. And anybody I get with this mutation, I will send them for sweat chloride. The funny thing is that, you know, obviously sometimes they're normal and that's fine, but we'll see some indeterminate ones. Sometimes we'll diagnose someone with like CF, like they'll have a sweat chloride in the 70s or whatever. And they'll go on for full length CFTR testing and they'll end up having like another minor mutation that wasn't in our genetic screen, for example. And so all those are really important things. I've diagnosed 2 75-year-olds with full blown cystic fibrosis. I mean, technically, you know, by the criteria with a sweat chloride over 60. So that I think is a pretty neat thing. But the whole thing with CFTR is with you have one copy of the mutation and it's showing that you're impacted. The Trikafta has been really nice. And I have was one patient with one copy of the F508 del mutation. And she had some, you know, chronic persistent Pseudomonas after surgery. And when she got on Trikafta, it's all gone. And her sinuses look terrific. And so it's a really good clinical correlation there. Interesting of note, you know, one of them got approved as a G542X mutation. G542X is a stop codon. So it's like you get truncated mRNA, you don't get any protein on that gene, but they still got approved. So it's going to be interesting to see whether that patient improves. Why is that? Because remember when I said about ivacaftor augmenting normal function, these drugs may actually just augment normal function of the other gene churning out protein, right? So, or the end result of protein. And so it would be really interesting to see and actually go in line with my theory of acquired CFTR dysfunction as well, that if this patient improves who's got the G542X mutation, then that actually kind of goes along the theory that, okay, you can actually augment normal function, improve people with just kind of, you know, persistent chronic infection or whatever to improve mucus clearance and to clear their sinuses and reestablish healthy, normal mucociliary transport.
So all of this is very interesting to me. I want to kind of look at a few of the things that you all have mentioned in a little bit more detail or kind of summarize them and get some additional comments. So one of the things that Doe mentioned is that the study from the early 2000s initially said that the CFTR mutation might be found in about 8% of CRS patients, but that was a little bit of a different sample, including polyps and non-polyp patients. And then in your study that has just come out, it was really more limited to non-polyp patients and finding that number of mutations in the non-polyp patients, particularly those with purulence, if I remember correctly, had almost twice as many mutations identified. So in translating this to clinical practice, and you all have mentioned, you know, a little bit about how some of this is kind of being used in the clinic, which patients that you see in a normal clinical day, which patients are you sending for these genetic evaluations? Which patients should our listeners be analyzing for CFTR mutations?
So in my case, I would say based on what I noticed was the, you know, like patients, because sometimes even though they're CFT carriers, I mean, you really don't have to do anything because you have certain level of CFTR function, they're going to be good, but recurrent sinus infections that, you know, everything's really perfect and you get antibiotics for 2 weeks or 3 weeks and then everybody are clear. All of a sudden, without any reasons that are coming back and say to another infection of Pseudomonas or staph. Interestingly, the highest number of the bacteria was a group of staph infection than Pseudomonas. So based on this small cohort. So those patients, I would recommend it, consider ordering this testing, especially those patients, because that patient's really high yield for those recurrence. So like, it's kind of day and night. All of a sudden, 3 months later, patient can have another like swellings and a lot of purulence coming out, culture it, like, oh, wow, why this is happening again? So I think that that's going to be really one of the things that probably really have to be looked into. Yeah.
I've always been really fascinated with like trying to figure out, okay, why, right? So why does this patient keep developing problems? And I obviously Doe and I are tertiary rhinologists, so we see this highly refractory patient population, as you do too, as Sarah. And so, you know, in that population, you get people who are just, okay, they come in and they've got eosinophils 16% and, you know, high IgE. It's like, okay, well, whatever, you know, it's obviously what's going on here, right? So that type of thing, you probably don't have to do it. Now, as part of what I'm doing now is I actually do a routine screening panel. I also send IgGs and that kind of thing just to kind of, you know, make sure that I have an idea about a snapshot of their immune system, snapshot of their inflammatory cascade, and in simple lab work that we can get. And so as part of that, I've been getting the CF panel as well. But if you're out in practice and you see someone and they, like, let's say they don't notice a bunch of allergy stuff. They've got kind of like polypoid edema, but not like gross polyps. They haven't had surgery where there's eosinophilic disease in the path, but it just says, you know, regular old chronic inflammation, and they're still refractory and developing like staph infections, Pseudomonas infections. These patients all really, in my opinion, should be screened for CFTR. And in fact, I have a kid I just operated on, 17 years old, you know, refractory, had surgery already. He's got all this polypoid edema everywhere. He's got an Ig under 20 and no eosinophilia. And the path is just chronic inflammation with no eosinophilia. And his CFTR screening was negative. But remember, you can have, this is only a little more than 40 mutations. So you can actually have other mutations. And so I've actually sent him for a sweat chloride, and we'll see what that result shows. But I'm just doing further investigation because he's, in my mind, a young kid who's having more problems with his sinuses, and none of it looks allergic or eosinophilic. I want to figure out what's going on here. And so that's kind of what my thought process is. You're trying to decide, okay, what is actually causing the problem? You know, in the old days, it was like, oh, well, it's functional endoscopic sinus, or you open the sinus, everything is fine. We obviously know that's not the case, right? So it's all about trying to treat the underlying disorder. Sinus surgery can assist with helping clear these patients, but it's not a cure in the vast majority of cases, especially with systemic inflammatory disease or CFTR-related disorder or immune issues, some of these things that we're seeing.
Yeah, what Brad just said is the, so the number one, we probably can do full genome sequencing, but that's very expensive. Screening testing. And then if you think someone is very recurrent infections, we can add this panel in your IgG or immunodeficiency panel and see how that goes.
Yeah, you know, I think that the approach that I have taken in my practice, which is, you know, a similar sort of referral type situation, has been, you know, as you all discussed, the recurrent infections, particularly with Pseudomonas and staph, you know, the edema, the purulence on endoscopy, and kind of the recalcitrance in that more sort of type one inflammatory pattern, less eosinophilia, that sort of thing. So I do have to say that your paper with this significantly sort of higher prevalence of the mutations might make me, you know, even screen more often. I appreciate that you all have done.
Yeah, that regular test isn't super expensive either. I mean, like, you know, in the grand scheme of things. So it's not like you're ordering a $3,000 test here. So it's a pretty routine lab now. So
and then Gary Cunning always advocate about full genome sequencing. He doesn't like the screening testing, but like,
it's so expensive. It's not practical at all.
There's no way that patients can even afford it. And another thing is, I asked the patient's history, like learning from the other colleagues, that family history, like, whether do you have anybody in your family like any kind of disease that they passed away very early, or and then oh yeah, and then it's like considering someone is infertility. So some of the CF mutations they don't know, but like males and females, they don't have kids. That also kind of a little bit of risk factor. Infertility is one of the things that like I've seen some people recently, a younger couple that are actually trying to figure out the baby and their screening. They said, oh, I turn out to be, I'm a CF carriers. So those kind of things can help us. I those ask two questions, whether anybody in your family is CF or anybody in your family has infertility and no kids. And those are kind of like signal that you may have CF carriers also.
Yes. And you also, you mentioned before about the, you know, kind of the GI history and the,
yes,
you know, the lower respiratory history. Those have been critical in my history taking as well. You know, personal history of those things and family history of those things. And so I think that all of those aspects can be helpful. The last question that I wanted to kind of ask and get some additional advice from you all. So if patients are identified with these mutations, heterozygotes with, you know, potential clinical impact, or, you know, obviously I think if they are homozygous and fully diagnosed with CF and qualify for one of these CFTR drugs, I think that, you know, that clinical scenario is easy to understand. But if they're heterozygous, are they qualifying for some of these CFTR drugs
that
have been so impactful? And is that a route that, you know, we can potentially look for, you know, to help our chronic recalcitrant sinus patients with?
It is, but the key is to have a good CF pulmonary team that's used to dealing with insurance companies and whatnot regarding these patients, right? So I've never, you know, I've actually never personally prescribed the CFTR modulator because it's all done through CF pulmonary. They have the system set up. And so, you know, one other point to say is that I actually have added someone with an F508del mutation that did get approved for the drug, even though the sweat chloride was normal, because they just kept having chronic Pseudomonas, right? So that's a really good point. So it's like, you don't, even though sweat chloride is a functional assay, and yes, it generally correlates to the amount of CFTR function, it doesn't always. And so the most important thing is just get them to the CF clinic. And so if they have a positive mutation, I would say just, and they've got this type of phenotype, it's a good idea, just send them to the CF clinic and just ask them to work it up. They can either go on to get, you know, full length CFTR testing, or you could also send them for a sweat chloride, which is a simple, easy test, but typically done at children's hospitals, and see if their functional assay is down. But like, if you have a really strong suspicion, it's probably just easier if you get a screen, just go ahead and send them to CF pulmonary.
The reason is they have access to better, more drugs than we do. So not only for the CF,
like, and the system for navigating the insurance complex. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. For example, like they also have pancreatic, like Pulmozyme or those kind of like mucolytics, something we cannot get in access. So those things, if even though they're not really candidate for expensive CFTR modulators, they at least get some other helps like chest vest, some other dietary consultations, or their consultation, social worker system. So they have a huge system to get involved. So when I talked to those patients, carriers came to like, what did you talk to them when you're there? They get tremendous help. Is that not only for that, oh my God, I spend a whole day with a team and spend like nutritions and also social works and everything that got benefit from that was, they said it was tremendous. So I think that also they get really beneficial from that. Yeah.
And that's a really good point, though. Like one of the things we've seen in the past is someone has a copy of one gene of the CFTR, but then they go and they get screened and then they get a CT of the chest and they've got bronchiectasis. And they've got 70% lung function. They didn't even know it. And so that's a really important point because some of this disease is pretty silent, or they just have cough and they're like, oh, I just have sinus stuff all the time. I don't, you know, and they just kind of ignore that the fact that they actually could have lung issues going on.
Right, right. So a lot of patients, they're also following pulmonologists that they never thought that this patient is CF carrier. So now we diagnose it and they,
And then we send it back.
Yeah. Sometimes they surprise. Wow. I didn't know that this patient will be the CF carrier. So, yeah.
So this has been great and enlightening discussion. I think that you all have done excellent work over the span of your careers and, you know, also with the the recent work that we're talking about today. So thank you. Thank you for all the work you've done. And so congratulations to you and your colleagues on your publication. Thank you, Drs. Cho and Woodworth, for joining me today. And thank you, of course, to our Scope It Out listeners. This is Sarah Wise for Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. And I'll sign off for now.